This is a HeadGum Original.
I want to tell you about a show I think you're going to love, and I'm not just talking to you. I'm specifically talking to Tom Hanks, if he's listening. I think Tom Hanks would love this, and not only that, I think he would be a great guest on it. Keeping Records, a podcast from HeadGum Studios. Here's the hook. In 1977, NASA sent the Voyager into space with two records known as the Golden Records. On them were recordings of notable historic music, evocative nature sounds, and murmurs from contemporary life, all used to paint a picture of humanity and the world at large. Now, things have changed a lot since 1977, so Caleb Heron and Shelby Wolstein are attempting an update. They're talking with comedians, musicians, and the like about what they would include on their own golden record if a new one were sent today. Songs, images, films, and moments are all on the table in this comedic reflection on art, media, and culture. I mean, I know I'm trying to get Tom Hanks on my podcast, so this is maybe an incredibly foolish thing to say, but it's true, right? He would be the perfect guest on this show. I mean, I had never heard of the Golden Records before, but I guarantee you Tom Hanks knows all about this, because if there's one thing Hanks knows, it's NASA stuff. And I'm certain that his picks for what he would include on his golden record would be thoughtful, fun, and surprising. Guests they've already had include Katie Delaney, Sabrina Jalees, Sydney Washington, Jake and Amir, Zoe Lister-Jones, and many more. Putting it out there, I want to be a guest on this podcast, and I'm going to spend a ridiculous amount of time sweating over my selections. Follow Keeping Records on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for doing this. I know that it's a very hectic time, so I really appreciate it.
It is, but you know what? Everyone blew me off tonight, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to come through right now for Connor.
Oh, that's great.
I'm going to come through the way Tom Hanks didn't come through. I'm going to make up for it.
A few years ago, when I was doing the warm-up for a taping of The Chris Gethard Show, I looked up and saw Judd Apatow in the audience. Judd Apatow, writer-director of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, producer of movies like Bridesmaids, The Big Sick, and one of my favorite movies of the last decade, pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping. I remember thinking, oh no, I wonder if I am being funny enough tonight. And then I pretended he wasn't there so I wouldn't be tempted to try and impress him. I didn't try to meet Judd that night. I think the warm-up was going well and I didn't want to ruin it by approaching him and saying something stupid. And I have to admit that I was a little nervous asking him to talk to me for this podcast, because I've been looking at his name on so many of my favorite things, going all the way back to when I was in high school, watching the Ben Stiller Show every Sunday evening on Fox.
Wow. At 7:30.
Opposite 60 Minutes.
Yes.
That was one of those shows that I'm sure you, as a self-proclaimed comedy nerd, you had those shows that you felt a certain amount of like pride of ownership and also like a certain outrage that why isn't everyone watching this? I would read the Nielsen ratings when they used to print them in the paper it would be like a list of, you know, 120 shows. And it really was like my sort of teenage badge of like, I get this and other people don't, that I would look at it every week and I would just be furious that it was like, if not the lowest rated show in that bottom five on the list.
Yes, and for a long time, so much of what I did would fail and disappear. You know, that was a very difficult period because I thought maybe I'm just completely out of sync with what people like. But so many of my favorite bands weren't the bands that were the number one bands in the world. You know, I was listening to Elvis Costello, people like that. And so I tried to take a pride in the idea that the crowd was not enormous, that there was hopefully a deep connection with the crowd, but it was small. And maybe that was okay. And maybe that's all that would ever happen, is I would do a series of things that would get canceled quickly or movies that would not do that well. But for a certain amount of people, they would be very special to them.
For a lot of people, Judd's TV series Freaks and Geeks was not unlike the music of Elvis Costello, attracting widespread critical acclaim and a devoted fan base who knew that something this good in a just world would be significantly more popular. When it premiered in 1999, it was possibly the best show on network television. and the people who were watching at home knew it. But there weren't enough of them to save it from cancellation. The final three episodes of an abruptly shortened single season were burned off in one night, about a month after I was fired from Band of Brothers. And for the next few years, the beginning of my wilderness period, I was keeping tabs on Judd's career, reading about all the TV shows with stacked casts that for whatever reason didn't happen.
I remember walking around the Sony lot with Ben Stiller, and I think a bunch of my pilots weren't picked up, and Freaks and Geeks was canceled, and Undeclared was canceled, and I was with Ben Stiller, and he just said, "Man, you need a hit." And that's what it felt like, because also when you don't have hits, everyone challenges your vision, because you haven't proven that your vision can work in a financial way by being a hit, by having a lot of viewers or selling a lot of tickets at the movie theater. So when you have a lot of these financial bombs, they start questioning all of your judgments, your casting, your writing.
At any point when you've been struggling, would you have that feeling where you'd look around at other people doing well and would you be comparing yourself?
Always. But I had that from a very young age because I wanted to be a comedian so badly. And I did it for about 7 years starting when I was in high school. And I was running around with people who were destined to be some of the greats. So I was living with Adam Sandler and I was friends with Jim Carrey and doing some writing with Jim. Rob Schneider lived across the street and David Spade lived down the street. And you can feel someone else's charisma. And I had this with multiple people and they were not famous. They were just charismatic and fascinating and interesting, great people. And you felt the room move to them. So when you talk about dead eyes, that's what I thought. I'm like, I'm the dead-eyed guy. I don't have the thing that's pulling that room like that.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. The reason I was told at the time was that he had looked at my audition tape and thought I had dead eyes. And that's the short version.
It really was like being a guy trying to start a band and your roommate's Bono. And you're going, "I don't think I'm as good as Bono." And then you walk in a room and everyone is so into Bono.
I was living in England when Freaks and Geeks originally aired on NBC, so I didn't see it until it was put out on DVD, years later. It was exactly what I needed to see at the time. A show about characters who were constantly being defeated, but learning how to be okay with it. Part of the reason it was canceled was that network executives wanted the characters to have more victories. Judd's response was that the whole point was to show how they survived high school with their compassion and sense of humor intact. In my eyes, back then, Judd was a very successful person who couldn't seem to make that success last very long. I felt like a guy who had fallen off the ladder of show business completely, but I was lying on the ground looking up at him, and he was climbing up a few rungs and then falling back down again and again.
I was doing stand-up once, and I was like 20 years old, and an agent saw me and said, "Do you want to go out on pilot season?" I was like, "Yeah, I'd love to be in a TV show." And so, you know, for people who don't know, pilot season is when they do one episode of a show to decide if they want to do a series. So he said, "Let me send you to an acting coach to evaluate how good your acting is." And he sends me to this acting coach. He gives me a scene from the show My Sister Sam. And the scene was really not funny, and so not funny that I didn't really even understand how to read it out loud. I've never, ever acted. Not a sketch, not an improv, nothing. And I'm terrible. And then the agent calls me and says, "Yeah," he said, "you're not a good actor, so let's not do this." And I never acted again. Off of one person saying that. And I can write for these people. I would write jokes for Jim Carrey, and I knew he would crush it. I couldn't believe how funny he was. But also, I always knew, wow, he's going to do it the way I dreamed I could do it.
Instead of having someone just immediately tell you you can't act, you think if you'd had someone who'd said, "Let's try it a little different," or "Why don't you try doing it like this," if you'd been nurtured in that way, that you that might have been a path for you?
I don't think there's any way to know. But I would say this, if that guy said, hey, go see that guy 3 times a week for the next 3 months, and let's work on this, and then we'll go do some stuff, I would have done it.
You probably would have gotten better, and it just would have been a question of whether you got better to a degree that it was worth continuing, I think.
Yeah, and maybe I would have gotten better but still not been interesting, or who knows, anything could have happened.
After a 25-year break from stand-up comedy, he came back to it in 2017 with an aptly titled Netflix special called Judd Apatow, The Return. And in it, one of the things he talks about is a specific piece of negative feedback he received early on from someone he looked up to.
Jim Henson was producing a show. He was looking to get a few comedians to drive cross-country with video cameras. And so I auditioned, and I got a call where they said, Jim Henson doesn't want you, but he would like to buy your ideas. Jim Henson said that he thought you lacked warmth. And it knocked me out. To this day, it knocked me out because he taught me how to read. And this is the warmest guy in the world. This is a guy who took felt and ping pong balls and made Kermit come to life. I mean, this, he was only joy and laughter. So for him to say I lacked warmth, which by the way, was my biggest fear on some deep level, a lack of charisma, a lack of some spark, and to hear it. And then like a month or two later, he died. I think he had the flu and had walking pneumonia or something, and he died. And that just locked it in forever.
I heard you tell this story, and I thought, this is the most relatable story I've ever heard. You know, if you were to make the very smallest quadrant of beloved and fun and likable and charming, just every positive quality you could associate, You'd put Tom Hanks and Jim Henson in that little corner, that little pocket.
Sure.
My guess is that your bond with like Henson probably runs deeper even than my bond as a fan of Tom Hanks's. That it's probably started earlier, and it probably was even more kind of emotional.
It's like a parent. And who knows how many hours I spent with him versus how many hours I spent with my parents as a little kid.
Why do you think that the message was relayed to you about lacking warmth? Like, do you think that Jim Henson wanted that message to be, like, make sure he knows?
That was part of it, which was, did he say it? Was it what the casting director thought? Did it get relayed properly? I can't imagine Jim Henson would say, could you please let Judd know that he lacks warmth? So is it an insensitive casting director? Or is it actually the casting director's opinion and wasn't even what he said? But also, sometimes people tell your agent, and your agent's not supposed to tell you.
Right.
You know, sometimes the agent's like, well, the judge shouldn't get that part, he's too old. And they're not supposed to go, they say you're too old. they're supposed to lie to you to keep your self-esteem. There was someone that I didn't cast once, and I was having a conversation with someone about it, and they said to me, they have dead eyes. And this is a very big actor or actress. And we thought about it. We thought about what it meant. We had a real discussion about accessibility and are you experiencing this through this person? And one might say that that person's career was great because maybe they seemed a little more tortured. They played people with different types of struggles. And it wasn't really dead eyes. It was emotion. It was pain. It was
right. They seem haunted.
Exactly. There's something there that wasn't appropriate for this part. That we at the time were like, something's going on there, and it's not what we're looking for at the time. But I think when you're in auditions, your job is to not say that to them. Your job is to inspire them to get to that place where they can do the thing you want them to do. So if you think someone has dead eyes, well, then you want to be playful with them. You want them to be as confident as they can be. You want to do it a couple of times and see what's possible. And I think a lot of what goes wrong is people give you one shot. I mean, I always say to people, the second you walk in, say, I want to do it twice. I'm not good the first time. Just tell them. And they'll always say yes. They'll always appreciate that you are aware. And a good director factors that in and gives you a little air and love and space because they're rooting for you to get it. They're not like, let me check out if this guy's got dead eyes, you know? And then you read it once, like, okay, that no, yeah, you do. The eyes are dead. You know, that's not what you do. I mean, I've had people who've been so bad in auditions, and then I'll go, well, let's just improvise on it a little bit. And suddenly they are fantastic.
How much are you able to take on the knowledge that every decision you're making in a process is creating this ripple wave of feelings that you may not be able to even be aware of? Does that weigh on you when you're in charge of something?
Yes. I mean, that's where I'm as Jewish as I could be. And on one level, I think it hopefully leads to people being treated well because I'm very concerned about what type of experience they're having. And on another level, there's something probably toxic and codependent. I remember when we did Freaks and Geeks, we would do the auditions, and Paul Feig was an actor for a very long time, very good actor. And every time someone finished a scene, he would laugh and then say, that's great, every single time. And, you know, like a very supportive, genuine kind of a laugh, not like bullshit. Like, he loved every person who came in. He really did. He knew what that struggle was and that pain was. But every audition, he would go, ha, 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 that's great. And we made it like a little montage of it, like as a joke, because he always did it. But it was the most loving thing to do. He, you know, and the best thing I've ever heard is when someone says, oh, I had so much fun auditioning for you, where it isn't the nightmare of their life, that even if they didn't get the part, it was something really positive for them, that they had fun with us and played and improvised, and it gave them confidence. It didn't make them feel awful.
I was working at a bookstore from 2002 to 2015, I was working at Barnes & Noble Union Square. And there was a point where I think Paul's second book had come out, and I told the person who arranged the events for the store, you should get Paul Feig to come here for the event. He's great. His book is great. It'll be a big event. People will be really excited. And so they did. And this is a story that kind of haunts me, how poorly I handled this interaction.
Wait a second. Let me say this. It's the perfect story no matter what's coming, because it's the exact story that fills Paul's life. Every story he told us during Freaks and Geeks was the most embarrassing story I've ever heard. And then we would always say, how old were you when that happened? Like 13. And he would go like, 18. Like, it was always like he was way too old for what it was. And then the show ended and he wrote a book of another like 25 stories that he never told us in the Freaks and Geeks writing room, and then wrote another book of humiliating disasters. And he turned all that into like fuel and comedy and his career. So yeah. I love that it went wrong.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, wait, let me hit record here. And great. I am now appear to be recording. All right.
Hi. Very nice to chat with you.
Thanks, Connor. You too.
When I was talking to Judd, I told him a story that you may or may not remember. My hope is that you don't remember in a way, even though it would be better for the podcast if you did.
Oh.
When we return, I'll be talking with Paul Feig, the creator of Freaks and Geeks, to ask him about what I said to him at that book signing in 2005. Dead Eyes will be right back. The latest film starring Tom Hanks, News of the World, is about to be made available to rent and stream at home, so I can finally watch it from the comfort of my apartment. It's a period film set in the late 1800s in Texas, and I could already tell from the trailer that this movie is going to have a lot of scenes where people sleep outdoors, on the ground. Maybe a few scenes in little frontier towns where I'm sure that the mattresses are nowhere near as comfortable is what you can get from Helix Sleep today. They have a quiz you can take online. It's really quick, takes about 2 minutes, and they can tell you exactly which mattress is right for your body type and sleep preferences. Everybody is different, and Helix knows that, so they have several different kinds of mattresses to choose from. They have soft, medium, and firm mattresses, mattresses to cool you down if you sleep hot, and even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size folks. I took the Helix quiz, and I was matched with the Midnight Luxe mattress because I wanted something that would accommodate tossing and turning. It was neither too soft nor too firm. Feels great. Perfect for watching movies set in the 1800s, which will perhaps make you appreciate how fortunate you are in comparison. So if you're looking for a mattress, it's really simple. You take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store again. And you don't have to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired Magazine. Just go to helixsleep.com/deadeyes. Take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights, risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it. But you will. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. That's up to $200 off all mattress orders plus 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. This episode is sponsored by Skillshare, an online learning community that offers classes in, where do I start? Writing, illustration, graphic design, filmmaking, music. So many different categories that you're bound to find more than a few areas of interest that can help you figure out how to express your creativity at a time when I think we all need that maybe more than ever. Explore new skills or help to hone the ones you already have, with affordable classes taught by experts who really know what they're talking about. One class that caught my eye, Creative Writing, Crafting Personal Essays with Impact, a 1-hour masterclass from bestselling writer Roxane Gay. Her thesis, which I totally agree with, is that everybody has a story to tell. Big or small, it's just a question of figuring out the right way to tell it. Broken down into 8 video lessons, she can help you not only figure out how to tell your story, but also how to get it out into the world and connect it to a larger conversation. Speaking for myself, I don't know what I would have done this past year if I didn't have this podcast as a creative outlet to tell my own very tiny and insignificant story. And on Skillshare, not only are there classes to help you figure out how to tell your story, they also have classes on, for instance, how to make a podcast. They can help guide you through the whole process. Or, you don't want to make a podcast? How about turning it into a comic book, or a song, or a series of watercolor paintings? Even if you're not sure what you might want to do, the great thing is you can sample a whole bunch of classes and see what feels right for you. Skillshare is easy to try, and it's super affordable. An annual subscription is less than $10 a month. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/deadeyes and get a free trial of premium membership. Go there, look around, try a few classes. It might be just the thing you're looking for in 2021. And trying it out won't cost you anything. That's Skillshare.com/deadeyes for a free trial of premium membership. I had planned in my head what I was going to say to you, thinking that it would be a really, I really put a lot of thought into it. And they brought me into the green room where you were, and they said, "Hey, Paul, this is Connor. He's the reason you're doing the event." You said, "Oh, well, thank you so much." And I said to you, "I'm such a big fan." And you signed my yearbook edition. And I said, "Can I just tell you that Freaks and Geeks is my second favorite TV show of all time?" Do you have any memory of someone saying this to you?
I think I do. I remember that event very, very well. That was very cool because it was a big deal for me as a burgeoning author. So, yes, that's hilarious.
Paul, like Judd, is a multi-hyphenate. Writer, director, producer. He created one of my favorite TV shows of the past decade that not enough people have seen, the sci-fi comedy Other Space. In addition to directing big movies like Bridesmaids, The Heat, Spy, and Ghostbusters Answer the Call. But he started out as an actor. He even has a small role in Tom Hanks's That Thing You Do. We'll get to that in a bit. And you were very nice about it, but I immediately felt so bad that I had...
Oh, no.
In my effort to make a very authentic compliment. I had delivered a backhanded compliment.
Well, we all have giant egos, you know that. So there's always part of us goes like, wait a minute, why isn't ours, my thing, the absolute best? But I hope I took it in the spirit that was intended, especially since I got to work on the one that's your favorite show, as long as I'm involved.
Right. I also felt like I had handed you another Paul Feig experience while also having one myself.
You know what? Actually, that's a great way to break it down, because had I done it, I would be beating myself up for years afterwards. I still think about things I said in my teens, and I'll replay it and go like, oh God, like I wish I could go back and undo that thing. But as the person that was said to, look, it's so nice for you to just get me there, and to be on anybody's favorites list is a great thing.
For the record, when I met Paul in the green room at Barnes & Noble, my number one favorite show at the time was Arrested Development, which Paul had also directed multiple episodes of. I sort of fumbled to try to explain this to him at the time, desperately trying to make it feel less awkward. Paul was, of course, very gracious, signing my yearbook, "Connor, you rule." But I always hoped that someday I would get a chance to talk to him about this, make it clear that I was not trying to weirdly neg him that day. Although he didn't seem to have a particularly vivid memory of how awkward it was, which is probably for the best. So much of your work is about defining what your success is and not letting it be defined by the larger world telling you you're a failure, that there are small victories.
Yeah, I mean, there's the road through the entertainment business is just paved with those. Because that's all you're really ever confronted with. I mean, the victories are so few and far between. Judd was actually the day that Freaks and Geeks premiered, and we were getting these amazing reviews. I mean, they were just coming in. It was crazy. I remember him saying, like, he said, I want you to stop and enjoy today. Just enjoy it. Stop. Don't think about the show. Don't think about the stuff we have to do and the ratings and all this. He said, just enjoy it. And it was such great advice, because I sort of wasn't. I was kind of, oh my God, these reviews are great, but oh, what do we got to get this and get that? And you know, we got to get this rating. And oh, what happens if we don't do this? So you do have to embrace those moments and enjoy them, because you are just confronted with constant failure. You know, it's why you're in the business, and it's why anytime somebody says to me, I'm thinking about getting in the business, or can you talk to my kid, he's thinking about getting in the business, like, no, I'm not, because what am I going to say? You know, all I'm going to say to them is don't do it, you know, and if they are going to do it no matter what, then yes, they should be doing it. But if I or anybody can talk them out of it, then you can't do it. You have to just be singular of vision and just have such... You have to have an ego. I mean, it is an ego, and there's healthy egos and there's unhealthy egos, but it's still, you have to have an ego that says, I can do this. When somebody says you're wrong, you're not right for it, or says you had dead eyes, there's two ways you handle it, and it's kind of a combo of the two. One, you go, yeah, I actually wasn't that good. When I went in there, I screwed something up, or I just wasn't ready. And then the other ones who just unfairly go, you're not good enough. Those are the ones that really drive you. And it becomes this weird combo. It's like when I was an actor and you'd have these auditions. And my thing was always like, if I stumbled over a word, I'd be like, oh my God. So then I beat myself up on the whole way home and all night of like, if I didn't trip over that word, I would have gotten the part. And now that I'm behind the camera and auditioning actors constantly, I've hired people that can barely get through the script, you know, because you just go, there's just something interesting about that person that I really like. And so you wish you could go back in time and go like, all right, all the stuff you cared about so didn't matter. Maybe it did to certain directors, but it didn't really matter to the people that would have understood what you did.
One of the first things I did right when I got out of drama school and I had an agent, they were sending me to be the reader in auditions before I could get any auditions. It amazed me how when a person walked in the room, how often that person got the part just from the way they walked in the room. Like how you got a vibe from someone. Mm-hmm. I was almost always correct. When they started reading, you'd be like, yeah, it was the same feeling you got from them walking in the room.
Well, it's that thing that you can't teach, you can't predict, but it's charisma. I mean, that's it. It's weird. Some people just walk into a room and you're just drawn to them. They have this natural energy. And when they're reading the part or they're doing it, you lean forward. You know, and I always say that's when I, you know, whenever I'm auditioning, I'm, you know, having been an actor, I give everybody the biggest shot in the world. Judd's joke was always everybody leaves one of your auditions thinking they have the role because I laugh and, oh my God, blah, 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 blah. Whether I, you know, thought they were good or not, just because I don't want them to have that experience of walking out and beating themselves up. But when you do it that way, you're always like, oh, that person could be good. Yeah, you know, I'm writing these notes. Like, could be right if we did this and this. And then the right person walks in and you're just like, oh, my God. And it just blows you out of your seat and you feel it. Like you say, you do feel it. Half the time you feel it when they walk in the room. And other times there's times when they walk in, and you're like, this person's not right at all. And the minute they start to read, you have this moment of like, wait, what, what? And then, you know, after a few things, you're like, wow, wait, this is really good. It's just not what I thought it was going to be. And I think that's the biggest mistake that a lot of directors and producers make is to go, oh my God, that person's so good, but I have something else in my head. And it's like, no, throw that thing out of your head. Don't let the great person walk away. Rewrite the role for the great person.
I talked to Seth Rogen, and he was talking about working with his partner, Evan, almost the opposite dynamic, because he said that he, having been an actor, was very aware of not wanting to give false hope to the actors in the room.
Interesting.
He said Evan would say things like, we'll see you soon or something. And okay. Seth would be like, you can't say that. You know, like you they'll think you're going to see them soon.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that in terms of being nice enough that they feel good about it, but not so nice that you're setting them up for a crushing disappointment?
I mean, I hate the moment of when you go, okay, thanks so much. And you see their face go like, aren't you going to give me another adjustment or aren't you going to help me out? So I will actually give everybody an adjustment. And then you hit a point where you're like, oh my God, I can't be responsible for all these people. And it gets very tiring. I'm always exhausted at the end of an audition day because I'm so worried about everybody else's psyche. Because I was in terrible situations. I mean, the worst I ever had was, I'm not gonna name names or the show, but it was a very popular show starring this guy, very popular actor. And I was excited about it. And I remember walking in and he was sitting me, it was in his office, and he had this big wooden desk. It looked like a lawyer's office for some reason. And he was back behind his desk reading a magazine, and then the casting people were sitting in front of the desk. I walk in, he's looking at the magazine, flips a page, he looks up at me, and then looks back down at the magazine and keeps reading the magazine and just reads the magazine through my entire audition. And I was just like, oh my God, that's cold. Now, cut two, I was a regular on a show and they wanted me to come into the auditions to read with people because it was for somebody I was going to be acting against.
Yeah.
And there was this one writer, again, I'm not going to name names. He was a Mr. Cool Guy kind of writer. And this older actor comes in. And he wasn't right for the role, we're all being nice. And he's reading, and this guy's just like laughing derisively, and he's like shaking and making all these things. And this actor stopped in the middle and goes like, you know what? I'm glad I could be your morning's entertainment. See ya. And he walked out, and I was just like, oh, devastated, because like I felt I was guilty because I was with these people, you know, with this guy.
And by association,
I never recovered from that.
Wow. I'm curious if you have a take on, you know, if someone else had told Judd, oh, you should try this or try this, whether they might have like stifled someone who could have been good at it, you know?
Yeah. Well, the infamous story was when we hired Seth Rogen, and we were talking to him after we hired him when we were on the pilot, and he goes, I had this acting coach there in Vancouver, and she told me I got to take voice lessons because if I talk like this, I'll never work. And it's just like the worst advice ever. Like the man's superpower is this fantastic voice he's got in way of delivery. And those are the moments when I go, you know what? Nobody knows anything. And everybody's just trying to judge things from what came before.
Did you audition for that thing you do?
Yeah. I remember that I remember this like it was yesterday. I actually got called in to read for the lead role. And so was, you know, so excited about that. Oh my gosh, you know, Tom Hanks is directing this and I'm up for the lead. It means you can come in and read, but in your head, you're like, wow, they must really want me. So, you know, I went in an audition and it's that bittersweet thing where they're like, oh man, would you read this? You go, oh yeah, this is a one day part. Okay, sure. But, you know, it was part of a DJ, and I've always had that kind of DJ voice anyway. And so I read it, and it was just Tom and I, and he burst out laughing. And he was just like, oh, my God, that's the greatest. And that was the greatest validation you could have ever had as an actor. You know, just like Tom Hanks is going crazy and saying how great it was. And I kind of knew in the room I had the part. It was just kind of even more than my bullshit when I you know, make actors try to feel good. You just knew. You know, sometimes you just know. And so got this part, but it was like, it was a one page scene. It was just all me talking for a solid page. But the fun thing was, or the funny thing was, is that, you know, all this buildup for months of, oh my God, I'm gonna be on this set. Oh, we can do all these things. I'm gonna try all this stuff. And I had all these like lines. I was gonna, kind of funny lines I'd come up with. I was gonna try to improv and surprise Tom with and surprise everybody else with. So we get in and we go to the set and they set up the shot and the camera's coming around and does this big master shot. You know, we do it a few times and then they go, all right, we got it. Great. Let's go. Moving on. And they scrambled because clearly now I know, you know, making movies like the they were behind schedule. And I remember as I walked off the set, I was on an empty stage. They had shot it in a warehouse in this other location that was the record company. And I remember just walking around going like, well, I guess that's it. And I got in my car and drove home.
Have you ever had to fire an actor or let an actor go because something's wrong with them?
Yeah. I think I only had it happen once that I can remember, but it was so terrible when it happened because it was also somebody we brought halfway around the world to be in this movie. And it was somebody I really liked and thought was great and had done a really fun audition tape and all this. And it just, I think it was a combination of jet lag. There may have been something they took to try to wake themselves up or something. And just a different style of working than I'm used to. But I will do everything in my power to try to get a performance out of somebody and try to push past it. And it was a whole day of this person not being able to get their lines out, of then getting kind of belligerent with the other actors. And then the night before had given my DP a whole list of ways that this person needed to be shot. And it was just like, oh, this is a problem. Damn it. This is a problem. And the only reason I was kind of able to do it is because when we ended that day, I just ended up spoon feeding this person lines, like literally say these two words, say these two words, say these two words. I was so exhausted at the end of the day that it was easier to just say like, we've got to replace this person. You know, I don't know what to do. Like we can't go through this. And then, you know, the other actors were very not happy with this person also. So it was a terrible, terrible feeling. And again, you want to just make sure that person knows that you still like them. It just, for whatever reason, something just didn't work. And, you know, and everybody goes on to have great careers and, you know, we're all professionals. So that's the good thing. You know, it's one thing. It's harder if it's like somebody you take a shot on who hasn't done anything before. But then your ego's like, I'm going to make this work because I went out on a limb to put this person in this and I'm going to get a performance no matter what. I don't care. Yeah.
Do you feel more in control as a filmmaker?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that's why I could never go back to acting. I mean, it was really driven home to me, you know, when I was on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, because, you know, I'd been a regular on four other TV series before that, all of which had gotten canceled after the first season. And then finally I got on this show that was a hit. And it was just the thing of like, finally, I did it. Oh, my God. All these years of trying to make this happen. I got it. I'm taken care of for 7 years. This is going to be the greatest thing. End of the first season. And they called me up and they said, we're writing your character out because we don't know how to write for him. And that was the moment of going. And I'd been wanting to get into directing up till then. And I'd always been writing episodes. I would write a spec episode of whatever show I was on and give it to the writers. I always really liked it. And then the show get canceled. So that never had a shot of possibly getting produced. But I kept going, oh, but I got it, you know, my acting career. And even my wife was starting to go like, you should really, you know, maybe think about, you know, something different, because just there is no control. And that was the moment when it's like, if I can be on a hit show and still get written out for no reason that I could see. I just didn't like that. Also, the way, actors' contracts were always terrible for TV series because they can get rid of you at any point, but you can't get out of that contract for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
Not that you would want to, but at the same time, that's definitely not control,
It definitely puts you in your place in terms of you can't leave.
Look, when you're an actor, it's all you can think about is the job and hanging on to the job and how do you expand it. And, but I have great sympathy for that. It's so hard to be a jobbing actor. It's the hardest gig in the world, I don't know if people in the public know this, but, how hard it is to be like a one-line, two-line actor on a thing because you're just waiting for the moment and dinner is served or whatever, however it is. But those are the easiest lines to screw up because and you have no sympathy from anybody because like how the fuck can you screw that up that you only have one thing to say? But it's like you don't understand, like if there's only have one thing you can say in life and it's gonna be in this one moment, it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, because there is a part of every actor that wants to make that one line the most important line in the show.
Oh, of course.
Even though that reading of it will ruin the scene.
Well, that's all. My direction always to the day players is like, do less.
Yeah.
Do less. Take it down. Take it. Throw it away. I know this is your big moment. Throw it away.
Well, there's one example I can think of, which is I think the first time I saw Jack McBrayer on a thing and he had one line. I think it was an episode of Arrested Development. He had one line and it was the funniest line in the whole episode. And he underplayed it. He didn't overplay it. He didn't sell it. But I saw that guy. I'm like, I didn't know who he was yet. And I was like, I don't know who that guy is. But he did such a good job with that line that I bet he just got onto another TV show.
I think I directed an episode, actually.
Really?
I have a weird memory of that because I met Jack before I went on and directed a 30 Rock, and I always liked Jack.
It was one where he comes to tell Jason Bateman, it's like an embarrassing moment where he comes to tell him that there's a problem with your credit card. It's been declined.
Yeah. I did direct that one.
Really?
Yeah, that was with, isn't that the one where he has to wear the giant jacket and everything?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I promise this is not, I did not plan this. This is genuinely organic.
No, I love that.
He whispers it, but it's a stage, the McBrayer line, he whispers it, but it's like a stage whisper. He says, there's a problem with your credit card. It's been declined.
Yeah, oh my God, yes. Oh, you know what? I will tell you, having been there, we laughed so hard. We thought it was hilarious. And I remember thinking, like, this guy is really got something. And then when he ended up on 30 Rock, he's like, of course.
Because it was the perfectly unexpected, it was like a whisper that actually ended up being louder than the loud part of the
exactly.
of the sentence. That's so funny because I don't even think on a subconscious level that I brought that up thinking that that would be an episode that you had directed.
I did 6 of them, so odds are pretty good.
In a way, talking to Paul felt like a kind of test case for tying up loose ends on a minor kerfuffle that no one else was fixated on but me. I can now replace my feelings of embarrassment and shame at possibly hurting Paul's feelings with satisfaction at getting to clearly express to him how much his work means to me. These things can end well. If Judd's feedback from Jim Henson is an example of a loose end that can never be tied up, his brush with comedy legend Steve Martin as a kid has a significantly happier resolution. How old were you when this happened?
I think I was 12 or 13.
So right at the age where it's not like a little kid doing it. It's not like a 5-year-old doing it. Like you're right at the age where you're starting to transition from being a kid.
Yeah, I would drive by his house because my grandma lived in Beverly Hills and she one day told me that's where Steve Martin lives. So I would always force her to drive by. So anywhere we went, I'm like, just make sure you take Bedford. And and then one day he was just there. I didn't go there to knock on his door or anything. He was outside washing his car or something. And I just jumped out of the car, and I said, will you sign an autograph? And he said, no, I don't sign autographs in my house, which is what you should say.
Yes.
You shouldn't,
Completely reasonable, yeah.
It's the right thing to say.
It's the exact perfect precedent you want to set.
Yeah. The amount of cameras I have outside my house right now, the amount of security I have two different security teams. And so I said, will you sign it in the street? And which I thought was a pretty good joke at the time. And he said, no, I'm sorry, because then a lot of people will come by. And he was very sweet and apologetic. And then I just wrote him a vicious letter, which I put in his mailbox. I didn't use a stamp, which I think is a funny, very aggressive thing to do. And I just said, you know, you wouldn't live in that house if I didn't buy all your stuff, all your records, and go to your movies. And if you don't send me an autographed photo of apology, I'll send your address to Homes of the Stars, and you'll have tour buses passing by 24 hours a day. And then I got books from him. And in it, he wrote, to Judd, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was speaking to the Judd Apatow.
The thing I love about that is that it's a hilarious joke at the time, and then it transforms.
Yeah.
That joke goes on a journey, because now it's really funny that Steve Martin has written this to you, and that it has a completely different meaning now that you are a professional.
Well, I've given it a lot of meaning in the years since, and I believe this to be true, although maybe I just created this meaning. But what I like to think about it is that I made him laugh. And he sent me the books because the letter was funny. And that in some way, it made me believe I could enter his world. That was my one moment of poking through. And to have that person acknowledge it with what felt like, by the way, the most generous gift I'd ever gotten in my life. You know, this book, and it was signed, and it was thoughtful. And on some level, he's telling me I'm funny and that I can do this. That's what I thought later. Many, many decades later, I thought that's the effect it had on me.
Did he remember that whenever, like later on when you met as adults?
I had one meeting about a project with him a long time ago, and someone made me tell the story. And somebody said, Steve, is that how you remember it? And he said, well, in my memory, I knocked on Judd's door, which I thought was a really funny response to it. And then, like 8 years ago, I was editing a comedy issue of Vanity Fair. And we did a photograph, which was Steve Martin with a tour bus outside of my house and me in a bathrobe, like coming outside to complain that he was in front of my house. So I had like this one day where we took this photo together, and it was just the greatest full circle day, us making this little funny picture together that talked about that.
If you were looking at my Deadeyes story, where do you think that story ultimately lands? Do you think this is something that's going to fizzle out and it'll just be something that I'm left wallowing in? Or do you think there's the potential for some other kind of ending to it?
Well, first I would say, are you saying that like you stopped acting after this for a long time off of that specific story? Or was it a culmination of things, or did something happen after it that made you stop for a while?
I think it's like you can intellectually know that a stove is hot, but when you press your hand down on it, that's when you learn it. And the Tom Hanks moment was really like, it stuck with me in a way that's like, I don't want to go near that thing. I'll eat cold food.
I think you're doing the reverse of what I did, which was when I was 16, I was interested in comedy and all of this. And I wanted to talk to people about it. And I wanted mentors. And I started interviewing comedians. And I interviewed 50 comedians when I was 16 years old. And it was, you know, 1983, 1984. It was Shandling and Seinfeld, you know, before they had, you know, reached their heights. Leno, similar to what you're doing now. I had an instinct to try to understand what was coming. You're trying to figure out what the fuck happened and what it means. I was trying to understand it before it happened to me. And so when I did those interviews, people would say, it takes a long time. It's a lot of disappointment. And people talked about it as if it was brutal. And they told all these stories of bombing and disappointments and things going wrong. And so you have to go into it with that spirit, which is, I love this. I'm going to try to get as good as I can. I'm going to make things that I'm proud of. And I hope I can make a living. And I hope it works out. But my core ideal has to be, I want to be good. I want to have this be a form of self-discovery. I want to have fun. And I'll be able to handle the brutal part.
Did knowing that it was going to be brutal in advance, did it really help you? Or when things started going bad, did you feel like it still was a sucker punch?
You know, I was talking to a friend today about this book that Gary Shandling gave me. It was the first book I ever read about Buddhism, and it was called Turning Problems into Happiness. And the premise of the book is that when something bad happens, you should be happy because it's an opportunity to learn and grow in some way. So you're actually happy that something goes wrong. Because you're like, oh, I can learn patience now. I can learn fortitude right now. Like, so much comes from it that just in a Buddhist, you know, half smile way, you think, yeah, this is what life is. Life is suffering, and we fight on in spite of it. Because to me, when someone says like he lacked warmth, what I know it means is I'm self-conscious, I'm tight, I'm insecure. Maybe I'm having a hard time. And so it comes across as not vital in some way. And I figured that out later. But, you know, at the time, it's like the reason why it hurt was like he nailed it. You know, he called it he lacks warmth. But I think what he also meant is like he's locked up. And that probably was part of where I was at that moment as a kind of a young neurotic, never been to therapy, never worked out all my issues, my family issues, my neurotic issues, and probably wanted that job so bad that I was probably weird doing that audition. I probably wasn't good and needy and didn't know who I was to get it across. It's always amazing when people really know themselves young and can get it across to people. But for a lot of us, it's a decades long challenge to figure out who we are and to get comfortable with it and to not hate it. You know, that's a hard part too. One thing that's always helped me, I always say this to my kids, you know, we're not supposed to agree on what we like. Metallica fans don't love Kenny Chesney and vice versa. And so on some level, you might be Metallica and Tom Hanks is Kenny Chesney, or you know what I mean? Like you could be doing different things and have different perspectives, or in that moment, he can't quite see what you are. He doesn't have enough time, or the material doesn't even allow him to actually understand what's interesting about you. There's a limitation to the moment. You don't have enough to do for your thing to come out.
So if you had to write an ending to my story, do you think it's that Tom Hanks and I are just oil and water? We don't connect?
Well, I don't think that it matters either way. You know, there's a version of a story where you work together or where he appreciates something that you've made or you have some other connection and it's fun and pleasant. And, you know, those things are always nice, but they're completely unnecessary because him not wanting you is somewhat meaningless because you're supposed to get rejected almost all the time. That was an especially painful way to have it done because it's a kind of, you think you have it, but it's not even a special story. It's kind of par for the course for what this is. There are big stars that got fired after one day. You know, Sean Penn was in a Terrence Malick movie and I think they like cut his entire part out. Alan Arkin was in like Bullets Over Broadway. They cut his entire part out afterwards. There's so many ways that this is painful that I think it's just giving it no significance at all is the perfect ending, and then just making the thing that's meaningful to you.
If Jim Henson was the guy who taught Judd Apatow how to read, I think Judd and Paul were the guys who taught me how to fail. Sometimes you fail by doing your best, then learning the right lessons from it when that's somehow not good enough. Often the ingredients for future success are buried inside those failures, if you're not too embarrassed to look at them closely. When Freaks and Geeks was canceled, the Los Angeles Times published an article. It was a series of journal entries written by Judd, chronicled his experience making the show, all the way from reading the pilot script that Paul wrote to winding up in a hospital bed because the stress of making the series had led to a herniated disc. In the final entry, one simple line stuck with me. It is hard to find closure. Speaking generally, I can't say I disagree.
shadow was cast. But now it follows a pattern. I don't know what that arrangement was. I could never tell, but you could. I don't know what that arrangement was. I could never tell. You could. I had hopes, but that's just because hoping was a well where you stood. I had hopes.
Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show was produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Judd Apatow and Paul Feig. Also thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use this song that's playing in the background. It's called Stuck in the Past, and you can find it on her Grammy Award-winning album, Mental Illness, available to buy at amymann.com. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast. Talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email address is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, who never appeared on Freaks and Geeks, obviously, but his first leading role in a movie was in the 1982 film Mazes and Monsters. It's about Dungeons and Dragons, the role-playing game which figures prominently in the final episode of Freaks and Geeks, which takes place in 1981. See you next time. Stay safe. Wear a mask, please.
Stuck in the past, just drawing rings around Saturn.
That was a HeadGum Original.